Hi, Avani Dias here. Thanks for joining me on the Hack Podcast. Did you know young veterans are more than twice as likely to take their own lives than the rest of the community? It's a pretty confronting statistic. And later in this episode, you're going to hear about what the federal government has introduced to prevent those suicides from going ahead. And a bit later, we're going to talk about Home and Away. It is one of the biggest shows on Australian TV, but its fans are really annoyed that a gay kissing scene was cut. And this is the second time that's happened. So we're going to talk about representation on Australian screens. Plus, there's been a lot happening in US politics, and we're going to break it all down for you.
Hack.
We're losing more people by suicide after our modern wars than we are actually fighting those wars.
History shows us that standing permanent bodies never have the punch of Royal Commissions.
On Triple J.
For years, young veterans and the families of those who have died by suicide have been calling for some action. And this is something we've been covering on Hack for a long time. These are the families of young vets Jesse Bird, who took his own life, and Jason Grant, who had PTSD and died of an overdose. They've been talking to us over the years.
It's an epidemic, really.
To say that you've trained somebody to go into fight and flight mode before they've ever been to war, then you send them somewhere and they're completely traumatized, and you have one appointment with them when they get back and they're apparently, you know, can go off and be a civilian. I mean, that's just rubbish.
He said himself, even with the PTSD, I'm glad I joined up. And as a mother, yeah, I'm not glad he joined up at all. He'd still be here with us.
Jesse's death was a statement, and it was a very clear statement towards recognition for what he was going through. And if we don't continue on with his fight, then he died in vain.
Hack. Triple J.
After such strong calls like that, today the federal government has announced there'll be a new national commissioner to prevent veteran suicide. There'll be $40 million put aside for it. If you're a young veteran, I'd love to hear what you think about this. 1300 055 36. Give me a call. Phil Thompson is here. He's a federal MP from Townsville with the Liberals. He's the youngest member of parliament at the moment, and he also used to be in the army. Phil, thank you for coming on Hack. You were diagnosed with PTSD after your time in Afghanistan. How prominent are mental health issues for young vets?
Thank you for having me. And this issue is extremely close to my heart. I was wounded in Afghanistan in 2009. I've lost hearing in my right ear. I was diagnosed with a mild traumatic brain injury, and I was diagnosed with a mental illness. This is something that, you know, it's so relevant to me, my friends, my family. And we just heard about Jesse Bird. We served together, lived together, worked together. You know, we were mates. It's mental illness and suicide attempts, and people that have died by suicide is a big thing, and a thing in the military, in the veteran community. And that's one of the reasons I got into politics, to be hopefully be a good conduit from the people that voices may not be heard, or people that don't have a voice anymore.
Phil, why do you think a national commissioner to prevent veteran suicide is the right approach to fix this problem?
Sure. And I think that the name and how it's said doesn't really do it justice. It's a national commissioner, but it's like a rolling royal commission. That's essentially what it is. It has the same powers to compel people to testify, to get evidence, and to do the research. And if we don't look back at where things have gone wrong, where the touch points are, how and why people have died by suicide, then moving forward just simply wouldn't be achievable. So doing this, a permanent position, a permanent team, as well as a family advocate whose job will be to link in with family members, link in with the veteran community, link in with the commissioner and the policy, you know, because I don't want to sit here and go, oh, we're just going to look about why people have died. No, that's not what we're doing. But we need to do that to look forward to go, how can we now move forward and put up have programs or whatever the recommendations need to be to actually get forward and really lower the high rate of suicide that we have in the veteran community.
All right, let's go to Dr. Daniel Mealy. He also served in Afghanistan as an army doctor. He suffered from psychological trauma. When he left, he went through homelessness, faced a number of other problems. Dan, thank you for coming on the show. What do you think about this national commissioner?
Thanks for having me, firstly, but I think that's this poses a whole new bunch of questions. Firstly, there's been very much public discussion about the need for a royal commission to investigate possible causal entities such as the ADF, DVA and the psychiatric and medical profession. But there's been virtually no public discussion until today about having a commissioner for the Defence Force and Veteran Suicide, or a veteran family advocate for that matter. Yet 282,000 Australians have signed a petition for a royal commission, all of whom Scott Morrison has ignored. And so I guess this poses the first question, why?
Let me put that question to Phil, because this is something we've heard from young vets like Dan, but also some families of people who have lost loved ones to suicide, who are saying, wouldn't a royal commission put a national spotlight on this issue?
Yes, but a Royal Commission is a moment of time. It has Royal Commission powers that is ongoing. And Dan, it's really good to finally catch up.
Yeah,
you know, it's over the radio.
Yeah, big fan.
We're actually mates on Facebook, and I follow what you do as well, and I think it's great.
Likewise.
And so my thing is that there hasn't. The discussion was taken to cabinet only a couple of days ago. I'm not in cabinet; it's not a thing that I'm there or privy to. But because this commissioner is going to have cross into state government jurisdiction as well by talking with coroners, and it's going to sit separate away from defence and DVA, because if they need to compel people from defence, then they will do that. If they need to compel people from DVA, they will do that. And I know the Prime Minister spoke with Julianne Finney last night, and I've seen her on TV today. What I want to see, and you know what, Dan, your job is to keep me accountable, is to keep your member accountable, to keep the PM accountable, because I'm putting my name, reputation, my whole life onto this, because I really, really want suicides to. I'm sick of burying brothers. I'm sick of burying sisters, and family members have buried too many of their loved ones.
Phil, I totally get that, and thanks for all you do for the veteran community. I'm a big fan, as I said before. We have to have discussion about this, because my first concern is that it's not immediately clear that the commissioner will have the appropriate military medical expertise at the outset to address this critical suicide issue. The commissioner will have the support of the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare and the Australian Commission of Safety and Quality in Healthcare. But technical expertise will be provided by coronial and legal experts, according to the press release this morning. Well, where's the appropriate medical expertise in this equation?
Well, we haven't got a commissioner yet. So what happens if the commissioner did have a medical background or a legal background? Would that then alleviate some of these concerns? Or?
Look, it would, but my second concern relating to this is that the setup of this new commissioner is not particularly transparent. While the new commissioner is said to be an independent body with power similar to the Royal Commission, given these concerns about how the new commissioner is immediately attached to the public service as an agency, I believe it would be more appropriate in the first instance to have a Royal Commission, which is more removed from the machinations of the public service and more likely to get to the bottom of the problems independently, and then a governing agency.
And I hear that. I hear you with that. The way that I'm looking at it is, so this commissioner does not get dictated to by any department, including PM, including the low levels of the member for Herbert or anyone else. Their role is to be independent. I'm more than happy to link in with you and fully kind of digest and take your questions and your concerns to the minister. I'm not the minister. I'm just someone like you, very passionate about this. But I want to see this start immediately. My view is a Royal Commission, and with this having similar, if not same powers, we won't see anything for 2 years. Or like, why can't we do this and start, you know, hitting target straight away.
You are listening to Hack on Triple J. We're talking about a new national commissioner appointed by the federal government to prevent veteran suicide. And we know this is a huge problem, especially among young veterans. On the Triple J Hack Facebook page, Russell says, this is a great thing. I agree that we don't need another Royal Commission and that this is the right approach. Glenn says, we probably should have put $500 million towards this instead of the upgrade to the war memorial then. And Mike says, this will only further delay real action to resolve the issue. How many servicemen and women will die before a prevention plan and strategies are implemented? Phil, I want to ask you about that, because how much is this because of systemic failures by the Defence Force and government?
What a pointy question. There's touch points and good and bad things that happen when you serve, and there's things that are missed or slip through the cracks when you transition or you discharge, and there's heaps of other factors that come into it as well, which includes marriage breakdowns and things like that. I believe that there's been a review after review after review, and there's something else, and then into DVA and the Productivity Commission and their recommendations and all these reviews and things, right? So I want to see action. I want to be nipping at the heels at the commissioner, asking where they're going and what they're doing. And I want to know that the family advocate is talking to Dan, is talking to Karen Bird, is talking to Julianne Finney, is talking to people in the community to not just listen, but we're here for change. I don't know, like, every suicide that happens in the veteran community, I feel the full weight of it, and I stand up and I talk about it every chance I can get in Parliament. I raise it, I spoke about it in my maiden speech, and I go speak to the Prime Minister and I speak to the ministers involved, and I try to get everyone. We want action. That's what we want, right?
All right. Well, that is all we have time for on this, which is such a huge issue, but I really thank you both for coming on and having such an honest conversation about this. Phil Thompson, who is a veteran and Liberal member for Herbert, thank you so much.
And thank you.
And Dr. Dan Mealy, who is a former Army doctor, thank you as well.
Thanks, Phil.
And I know that this is a conversation that can be pretty difficult, so if it did raise anything for you, call the Veterans and Veterans Families Counselling Service on 1-800-011-046, or you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Hack. Technical glitches held up the results in the first contest of the 2020 US presidential elections.
On Triple J.
There's heaps going on in US politics right now. It's pretty complicated. I feel you. Let's get through this together, because there's a huge election coming up in November this year. So the biggest update this week, the Democrats are in the process of choosing who will run against Donald Trump. And that involves a bunch of small elections, basically, where Democrats are voting to decide who their candidate will ultimately be. The first of those happened in Iowa. It started yesterday, and whoever wins that is often in a really good position to win the Democrats' candidacy, but things did not go to plan, and we're only just getting the results today. So Tim Swanston has the latest.
This is a really major screw-up, and this is the Super Bowl of politics. This is the big day. It's everything.
It's safe to say it was a shocker of a night for the Democrats in Iowa. Yesterday, as people in the US and across the globe were eagerly awaiting to see who the frontrunners of the Midwestern state's Democratic caucus would be, the results just weren't coming in.
We got much more coming up, because we are still awaiting our first results from the Iowa Democratic Party. We have nothing so far. NBC.
American primaries and caucuses can be pretty confusing. So let's take a step back for a moment and look at what was meant to happen. You probably know there's quite a few people who want to run for the Democrats against, most likely, Donald Trump in November. To cut a long story short, the way that nominee is picked is through all these mini elections of caucuses and primaries at a state level. If you do well, you pick up delegates. The more delegates, the much better chance you'll be the nominee. Iowa is the first state this year to run its caucus, so people are pretty damn keen to see who emerges with the most delegates. And this year, they decided to use an app for the around 1,600 precincts to report their results back to HQ.
There was a lot of issues with caucus chairs downloading the app that was going to report the results from these caucus sites around the state.
The DNC revealed the app used to record the results from individual caucus locations failed, leading to inconsistencies. It's now manually verifying the ballots.
Yeah, yikes. So instead, some people at precincts tried to phone the results in with frustrating and, look, sometimes hilarious results.
I'm just waiting on hold and doing my best to report the results.
Okay, party. Can I help you?
This is a real coincidence, Wolf. I just got off hold just now. Yeah. So I've got to get off the phone to report the results.
All right, go ahead. Report your results. Can we listen in as you report them, Sean?
Yep.
All right, let's listen.
All right. Okay, hi, hello? They hung up on me.
If you were looking for a way to undermine the eventual winner of the Iowa Democratic caucus, or just generally make the Democrats look a touch pathetic, well, here you go.
This mattered. These campaigns put a lot of money, a lot of resources that they could have put in other places. They were making big bets on Iowa. Who's going to get talked about and in what way between now and New Hampshire? You know, this is very much domino effect, especially with media and narratives.
That's CNN's Chris Cuomo.
Literally, this state had one job. They had one job, and they blew it at the most important time in the election. The criticism should not be mitigated by any means.
So you can imagine that if having a great result was meant to be the wind in your sails before the next Democratic primary, a massively delayed and now undermined result is pretty crap news. Most of the results were finally able to be reported earlier today, and it looks like former Mayor Pete Buttigieg, a 38-year-old openly gay veteran, has picked up the best result.
Tonight, an improbable hope became an undeniable reality. So we don't know all the results, but we know by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have shocked the nation.
Senator Elizabeth Warren and former Vice President Joe Biden look like they've picked up the third and fourth best results, respectively. But Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is hot on Mayor Pete's heels, and he's already pitching to the next state holding a primary.
But I am confident that here in New Hampshire, I know they'd be able to count your votes on election night. And when you count those votes, I look forward to winning here in New Hampshire.
Tim Swanston there on the Triple J Hack Facebook page. James says, there's no one in the Democratic Party that can win against Trump. It's Trump 2020 easily. Four more years. Ellis, you say Buttigieg and Sanders have had a slight hit to their momentum due to the late counting of the votes in Iowa. Their victories have been downplayed, and that leaves room for Biden to start fresh in New Hampshire. Interesting take. And Gary says, the circus is open for business. Yes, it definitely is. And that's not even the latest thing to have happened. There's so many more things I want to update you on in US politics. John Barron is here. He's from Planet America on ABC TV, which is all about American politics. And he's also from the US Studies Center. So he's been following this for a very long time. John, so Pete Buttigieg has come out on top in Iowa, but there are a lot of concerns about his connection to this new app, and it was untested, right? And it's delayed the vote results coming out. Is that a legitimate concern?
Look, it's certainly something that goes to Pete being quite close to a lot of big donors in Silicon Valley. He was at Harvard with Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. He's taken a lot of money from there. And it kind of also goes to the fact that everyone thinks, hey, he's 38 years old, he's openly gay, he's married to a dude. But he is actually a Rhodes Scholar who was the mayor of a small conservative town in Midwestern Indiana. This guy is not nearly as progressive as, say, Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. And so there is a bit of a narrative around Mayor Pete that maybe this guy isn't quite who we think he is. One of the same criticisms that, of course, was made of Barack Obama some years ago when they said, this guy seems like a really historic sort of progressive candidate, but in fact, he's quite moderate in his politics. Similarly, you could argue that Pete Buttigieg is also quite moderate, even centrist in his politics, which is why he's not necessarily the president presumptive nominee, even though the last four Democrats to win the Iowa caucuses have gone on to become their nominee. So it's a big boost for him, but it may not be enough.
Yeah, it seems like he's kind of come out of nowhere, because we're hearing about Elizabeth Warren, we're hearing about Bernie Sanders, then he just comes out and is probably going to win Iowa. Are you surprised by that?
Look, there are some candidates like Barack Obama in 2008 who put all their cards on a win in Iowa and then getting momentum, going into New Hampshire, the next state, and then taking off from there. But if you're a candidate like Joe Biden, for instance, well, it doesn't matter so much if you're looking to build a very broad-based coalition. To win in a state like Iowa, which is 93% white and quite conservative as well, and then New Hampshire, which is about 91% white, well, that's not America. These are you know, mostly rural states as well. This is not urban, multiracial America. So Joe Biden is sitting back thinking, okay, as long as I can do well in South Carolina later in the month and then Super Tuesday in a month from now, I've still got a shot at this. But you're right. Ordinarily, if Joe Biden is the national front runner, he's still about 5 or 6 points in front of Bernie. If the national front runner comes third, much less fourth in the Iowa caucuses, they're toast. Howard Dean in 2004, Hillary Clinton in 2008, coming in third, they never recovered from that. They couldn't win the nomination. This is bad news for Biden, but there's also bad news in Iowa for Bernie, because he didn't get the turnout that he was hoping for. And yes, he'll probably win New Hampshire next week, but he beat Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire by 22 points 4 years ago. So he's expected to win. So, you know, this race has a very long way to go.
So unpredictable. On the other side of politics, though, Donald Trump, US president, gave a State of the Union address today. Can I firstly ask why in US politics does the president just get to do a speech once a year unchecked?
This is because the president is invited by the Speaker of the House of Representatives to give not just a report on the State of the Union, tell us what's happening in the big wide world, Mr. President. This dates back from, you know, George Washington's time when they didn't know what was going on from cable news. And also to give the president an opportunity to say, this is what, it's like the Queen's opening speech of a parliament. This is what I would like the legislature to do this year. And if you pass these laws, I tell you now, I will sign them. And that's how laws get passed in the United States. Instead, Donald Trump being Donald Trump, he started off using this basically as just a way of rattling off his achievements.
Yeah, it was like a campaign, basically.
But then it went complete reality TV. He suddenly calls out, there's Rush Limbaugh dying of lung cancer, but I'm going to give him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honour.
Just to check, he is a conservative radio host, so it's bizarre that he's getting a Medal of Honour in this address, right?
He is not just a conservative. He is a racist, homophobic, misogynist, but very popular with conservatives. Mm. And now everyone feels sad for him because he's dying of lung cancer after, for years, saying tobacco is not addictive and smoking doesn't cause emphysema. So, you know, karma, Rush. So Rush, in the middle of the speech, Trump stops. Melania, his wife, turns to Rush sitting next to him in a wheelchair. He stands up. He's given this medal. That never happens in a State of the Union. Then he has a reunion of a military family. Your dad's home from Iraq. Suddenly meet the wife and kids. It's happening on live TV in the middle of the State of the Union. It was extraordinary.
It was very entertaining to watch. And this isn't the end for Trump, because tomorrow his impeachment hearing is happening. He is likely to get acquitted and move forward into the election. But thank you so much for getting us up to speed, John Barron from Planet America.
My pleasure.
And if you want to know more, you can watch John Barron and the crew on Planet America at 10:15 tonight on ABC TV, or you can catch up on iView.
Hack. I don't know why they weren't shown in Australia and they were in New Zealand. Like, it's not a great look.
Triple J.
When was the first time you saw an LGBTI character on TV? Home and Away is one of the biggest and longest running shows on Aussie television. But this week, the show cut a kiss between a lesbian couple, Alex and Willow. They're the characters' names. And I should add, this wasn't like a huge makeout scene. It was just a peck. But this isn't the first time this has happened. Late last year, two kiss scenes between the same couple were cut, but for some reason, it went to air in New Zealand. At the time, Channel 7 said it was an accident and they aired the wrong episode. But now that it's happened again, critics are saying, surely this wasn't just a mistake. I want to hear from you. When was the first time you saw an LGBTI character on TV? or more broadly, yourself reflected on television or in movies? 1-300-055-36 or shoot me a text 0439-757-555. Now, Alex Shillington covers LGBTI pop culture on YouTube. She's been following this Home and Away story from the start. Alex, how did you feel about this scene being cut again?
Pretty hurt. Not surprised because, you know, Australian TV doesn't have a great reputation for lesbian couples. So I wasn't surprised, but hurt, definitely.
What message does this send to LGBTI fans of the show?
I mean, I've been seeing a lot of people saying that, you know, they feel like this is sending a message of their sort of love and or affection or just themselves should be hidden and, you know, are not allowed to have the sort of same presence as straight people or couples.
On the Triple J Hack Facebook page, Joe says, the public have grown up quicker than the producers. Chris says, who cares? If it's not integral to the scene, then it doesn't need to be there. What do you say to that point, Alex?
I mean, there was a scene that was cut that was actually integral to the show back last year. There was a scene cut sort of at the end of one of them where they kiss, and there was an extended period of that scene where they talk about going on a trip. Later on, a couple episodes later, that trip was referenced, but because it was cut, it was confusing. So, like, that scene was actually integral to the storyline.
So bizarre that they cut it. Why do you think that Channel 7 is so concerned here?
I genuinely don't know. You know, they said that they accidentally aired the wrong version.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure why there was two versions made in the first place. I genuinely am very confused about it. I'm not sure why New Zealand got, you know, the unedited version and you know, yeah, if they didn't want it there for creative reasons or whatever, then how come that unedited version was made in the first place?
Some commentators are saying, you know, free-to-air TV is losing people to streaming services and things like that. They're just freaking out, so they're being extra cautious. Do you think that's a valid claim?
I think it's interesting because I think people, I mean, especially younger audiences, are going to streaming services away from free TV because they don't have those diverse storylines. You know, Netflix and Stan and all those sort of things are doing, they've got really interesting diverse storylines, and they're not just, you know, the black and white storylines or the, you know, straight white storylines that we're seeing on free TV. So I think that's the reason why younger audiences are moving away. I think, yeah, you know, they're moving to YouTube because there's, you know, daily free content. But, you know, soap operas like Home and Away is daily free content. So if they had that kind of representation, I think they wouldn't be losing those people.
Emily from Newcastle's called in. When was the first time you saw a gay scene on TV?
It was on a show called Grace and Frankie.
Yeah. And how did you feel when you saw it?
It was surprising because I've never actually seen anything like that in real life, or I've had like a pretty sheltered upbringing, and yeah, it was surprising, but it was actually really nice to see sort of mainstream media be so inclusive.
Yeah, what was the importance for you to see something like that?
I don't know, it opened my eyes and made it feel normal. Like, this is a normal show that I really enjoy, and Yeah,
totally. Thanks for the call, Emily. Alicia on the text line says, there are still so many homophobes around. It's really sad that in 2020, love is still being censored. And John says, take a leaf out of Sex Education's book. That's a show on Netflix. Sure, it's not a soap opera, but it does a fantastic job of normalising all sorts of relationships. That's a valid point, right, Alex? Because Sex Education, I feel like the characters who are LGBTI, it's not even central to their narrative. It's just that's who they are.
Sex Education is a great series. They touch on so many different topics, not just, you know, sexuality, but, you know, they have done a great job in telling lots of different stories, like lots of different representation, not just, you know, in regards to LGBT sexuality. But yeah, I think they've done a great job there, that series.
Yeah, totally. Thank you so much, Alex Shillington, for coming on the show to chat about Home and Away and, Yeah, there are issues there, cutting a gay kissing scene for the second time. Heath says, yet Neighbours has a married gay couple and a transgender character. That's true. Another Australian show which is seems to be ahead of Home and Away in that sense. And someone's texted in, I saw a lesbian kiss scene on Neighbours probably 15 years ago. And another texter, I'm a straight white male. I'm also almost getting sick of seeing myself represented on TV. That's Ethan from Melbourne, and that's a pretty funny point.
Hack on Triple J.
That's all we've got time for. I'll catch you later.